Well, I had been, so my academic background mm-hmm. is as an ecologist okay. and specifically an agroecologist. Mm. So, you know, I've been studying for the past 15 years, a lot about the interaction of humans and the environment. Mm. A lot of how environmental issues and environmental policies and research even had previously, you know, been organized as, you know, kind of a divide between nature and culture. Like, humans are over here, and they're inherently degrading to ecosystems, and then we'll just study ecosystems. We'll sort of put one aside and kind of look at it and see what it naturally does. But that's not how our environments work on this planet. Mm. You know, humans have been on this earth now for, 700,000 years? Our current species manifestation. Mm. And you know, there's the really important study that just came out last month that showed that for at least the last 12,000 years, humans have been actively interacting with environments in ways that enhanced them as well as ways that degraded them. And I wanted to look at that because, you know, I really got concerned with climate change and peak oil and all of these sort of planetary issues in the early 2000s. And you know, all of the stuff about the narratives kind of struck me as a little odd. Like, you know, especially the ones about like overpopulation, right? Mm. Because when people talk about overpopulation, especially in this country, you know, the major image that comes to people's minds are black and brown people, right? Black and brown people having a lot of babies and overpopulating. And, you know, it's always had that tinge of a white supremacist narrative here, especially here in the United States. Mm. And I knew sort of in my bones that that narrative was not the narrative that we needed for this moment, obviously because of the racism, but also something deeper. As you know, we are on this planet. We're a part of this planet. How can we be like, how can we inherently as a species be a detriment to this planet? Mm. That doesn't sound right to me, you know? And I started looking first at land ownership. Okay. Mm. So you go down the 5, right? You go down any freeway or in this area, especially, or in this town. Mm-hmm. And what you see is not a natural landscape. Mm. What you see is not like, you know, a population pressure. You see a landscape of ownership, right? You see these giant plots of land held by large corporations and water brokers and rich people that humans are not allowed to exist on. Mm. So how the heck can we talk about population issues when we have a land ownership problem that is so severe that we can't even think about how to talk about you know, carrying capacity? Not that it isn't a concern, but how can we talk about it when people, especially black and brown people, especially the people that are thought of as being the overpopulators, have no access to land and no access to the things about subsistence? So I started looking at subsistence, and you know, I finally, after 12 years in community college, I call it my 15-year plan for to go to college, I went to UCLA, and I started actually, you know, I had these wonderful professors, and I started actually looking at first the experience of African peoples on this continent and the African diaspora and how enslaved people resisted and survived and were able to carve out, you know, lives for themselves, not just in the shadow of slavery, but also in the pursuit of freedom. Mm. And so you know, I had a wonderful teacher, Judy Carney. She wrote the book Black Rice, about how enslaved African peoples brought African plants to the New World, and you know, it became sort of naturalized parts of ecosystems, and they were able to also ally with indigenous peoples, you know, in communities of resistance. And that really spoke to me in a huge way, because as I was to find out later, much later, you know, I too come from a people that survived in the Philippines. My parents, my dad's island was the site of a genocide. And so this theme of like survival, resilience, that utilized and was in partnership with the environment, really, really struck me. And then I started working with my main advisor, who would be my advisor throughout my PhD program, Susanna Hecht, who studied the Amazon. And the Amazon forest is an amazing place.
Sure.
For so many more reasons than people think.
Yeah.
They think it's just this land of natural beauty and abundance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I learned quickly that that is a colonial narrative. People made the Amazon. Up to 20% of that rainforest is anthropogenic, meaning people planted them. People planted those forests. People burned those forests. Up to 25 million people lived in the Amazon before colonization. They lived in urban centers, very tightly packed, densely packed, along the waterways. And the more I learned about that, I just... That just caught my imagination of like, wow, this is like the best like and worst, that it is a secret, but it is a wonderful secret, that this place that most people think of as the most naturally biodiverse place on the planet would not have been that if it weren't for humans. So there was this key that I started to follow about how indigenous peoples lived in a way that not only was in harmony with the environment, but created
enhanced
it.
Yeah.
And made it more abundant and made it more biodiverse. And so, you know, and so when I went to, so I started working, I continued working sort of in these two tracks. One, you know, again, the contribution of indigenous peoples to an environment as amazing and diverse as the Amazon, and also a continued working with African diaspora communities. I went to, did my master's at University of Chicago and worked with a food collective, the Healthy Food Hub in South Chicago, which was in the Black community, but mostly a lot of people involved in that actually came from just four counties in Mississippi. And it was one of the four counties that during Reconstruction, a lot of, you know, newly freed enslaved people had come to make lives for themselves. And they were carrying over a lot of those rural agrarian practices into the heart of the city because they were living in a food desert. And you know, so that, you know, brought these threads together of like ancient practices of resistance, practices of community that are operating right now, today, in the present, you know. And that's always fascinated me. And I think that does come from, you know, my immigrant background. I grew up right in a garden. I grew up, you know, with my grandmother and my family.
Where was this, may I ask?
I grew up in Los Angeles in Burbank, California.
Okay.
So in the San Fernando Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I guess it was just something about that just really trained my eye. You know, once I started to learn about plants and identify them and look at them, I started to see gardens everywhere. Even in these places that are so-called food deserts, you know, there were medicinal plants growing. There's like, you know, other plants growing depending on the type of community. There's always, you know, a host of plants that are precious to that community. And that, you know, people bring their traditions and their practices with them, right? So I started my PhD at Berkeley, and I went to the Amazon for like 2 years to study exactly that, how people were bringing those practices of the forest, of forest stewardship, and of, you know, basically creating forests to sustain their needs into the urban areas. So I lived in a sort of a poor suburb, exurb, what they call a land invasion. So in Brazil, housing is very interesting. It's kind of not a problem because there are these sort of loose land laws that allowed whole communities to basically move into an area and like put up a whole city, right? And after 5 years, the government recognizes it and brings services. And so I lived in one of these areas where, you know, again, there's not a lot of cash economy. You know, people live under the global poverty line. And so they survive by recreating the forests in their own backyards. And these were places that were cooler than the rest of the city, especially at a time when climate change is already hitting the Amazon. And, you know, consistently the days are over 100 degrees, you know. So I sort of had that background already when I came back to the United States. And then politics happened because that was 2016. Right? So I sort of really got involved in political issues. We can talk about that later. That was another whole kind of complex set of issues that drove me out of the Bay Area and into my car going around the country. Lived in my car for several months, and then I ended up here in Chico. about 6 months before the campfire. And at that moment, I thought that I had left my academic career behind. I thought that, well, you know, I'm not sure what I'm doing now. Like, was the last 10 years a waste? And then I met Allie. And we talked, and she told me about what she wanted to do with the forest contracting. And I was like, oh my God, this is everything that I've been interested in and I've been studying. And a lot of people would tell me in academia that, you know, oh, so you're going to do international work. This is not really applicable in the United States. And then after I talked to Allie, I was like, no, of course it's applicable in the United States. Hello. Like, they're indigenous peoples are still here. They're still doing the thing. And now we have a real chance to shift the paradigm that exists here in this country. That is, it's the hold of this narrative of that we are separate from nature, that, you know, these ancient practices can never come back, all of this stuff. Those narratives are so strong here, stronger than in any other country, really. And, you know, this opportunity and this chance to bring this real life-saving work to a place like the United States, where we're like the most colonized, you know, in many ways, and to decolonize just this place, just, you know, I mean, like that was the thing, you know. How could I not do that?
This is Corey Hunt on the Peace and Social Justice Show, speaking with Mel Figueroa, the policy manager and all around background of the Chico TEK program. And this is the Peace and Social Justice Show. Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And by Chico Velo, supporting bicycling education and advocacy since 1980, Chico Velo encourages you to ride your bike and park it safely at the Bike Valet when available at the Thursday Night Market and Saturday Farmers Market. For more information, visit chicovelo.org and find them on Facebook.
You mentioned going through all this labor to get to college. Then you finish college, do more labor, get to the master's program. After all of this, you end up living in your car. And so I kind of wanted to speak to that maybe and figure it, hear how this turns about.
So yeah,
if you're open to speaking to it.
Sure, you know, it gets easier to speak about it after a while. So I came back after my field work to 2016, which was an incredible circus. I had gotten the opportunity to work on Jill Stein's campaign for the Green Party. So I kind of had a front seat to a lot of the madness that was the 2016 election, which was also very, very enlightening for me to, you know, to have contact with the circles of mainstream media, of, you know, mainstream political organizations, and to look at sort of the realm of what is commonly known as politics up close. I say this because there's so much politics everywhere, but what people generally in the United States recognize as politics is elections.
Yes.
So that was very interesting. And then then after that, you know, and after the recount, that was also a huge thing. If you recall that Jill Stein had sued for a recount in three states, which could have gone through, but we can talk about that. If Hillary Clinton had actually fought for herself, which she didn't, interesting tidbit there. But but anyway, in any case, I came back to Berkeley at a time when Trump had just been ascendant, and these groups, these white supremacist groups, these neo-fascist, you know, online groups were just starting their activities. And if you recall, in 2017, there was a big battle at Berkeley, or say a big fight, as the white supremacist groups began to target our campus. And, you know, from afar, from just reading the news stories, it appeared like, oh, you know, there are these radicals at Berkeley, and then there are these people trying to, you know, these right-wing people, maybe they're right-wing, but, you know, they have free speech, and that's what it, you know, that's what it looked like if you read the news about it. That wasn't what was happening at all in our campus. Our campus and, you know, my colleagues, my students, myself, we were being very much targeted. It was a real climate of fear on that campus during that year. People were being harassed. They were being doxxed, right? Their home and their... but there were also, like, Proud Boys were beating people up in the street already. You know, this is not something we heard about until much, much later. But it was happening at Berkeley. People were being followed home from their classes. People were being, you know, outed. Like, there were people who were, you know, say, like, working as sex workers on the side because you have to make money, and they were being outed to, like, parents. There's all kinds of stuff that was going on that really created such a climate of fear and real terror that was going on. You know, Berkeley was one of the few campuses who fought back, but this was happening at hundreds of campuses all over the country. People were dying even before Charlottesville. You know, counted five people who died on campuses and were stabbed or were killed. This was also, you know, the time when school shootings were ramping up, and I was, you know, I'm teaching a class, and I'm just every time going on campus expecting something really bad to happen. You know, I mean, like, preparing for your class, but also preparing your contingency plan for if somebody comes into your classroom with a gun, you know. And coming back to that, and also not being believed by, you know, the mainstream people, like, literally sitting in rooms where people are just discussing Berkeley like I'm not there. Like, oh, you know, well, maybe somebody just has to get hurt to, you know, to make the point. And I'm sitting there as like, oh, so you mean me? You mean my students? Somebody I know? One of my friends? One of the people I love dearly? Like, these are the people you're talking about. And so, yeah, stuff got really real. And and the threat of these groups, the threat of these like Proud Boys, and you know, this threat that culminated, I guess, in that January 6th riot at the Capitol, began way before. And so I had a front seat to kind of the first, you know, wave of that. And it was just too much. It was too much.
Okay.
It was too much for me. I was being traumatized by, you know, I was being overwhelmed by fear stepping onto my campus. And so I couldn't take it. And so the only thing I knew how to do was to sound the alarm. It's the only way, because, you know, the media wouldn't cover it. Nobody else would cover it. Everybody had their own opinion that weren't there. And so I realized the only way that I knew how to deal with it was to deal with it the way I knew how, was as a grassroots organizer. And so I'm really thankful that I had comrades that understood me, that listened to me, and were able to help me to put on organizing workshops across the country to, you know, show people sort of what the threat is, but also to respond to that threat, not in a sort of equally, you know, how do we fight fascists? We don't always fight fascists with our fists. We fight also by creating a society in which fascism is not an attractive option.
Mm.
You know, fascism happens when we do have a society that is willing to throw people away, right? I studied what happened in Germany. I studied what happened in a lot of these societies, and you know, they were all populations that people didn't care about anyway, right? Or that were hostile to, and they were okay with it. You know, again, it's like the what's that phrase? The minimum that fascism requires is for good people to do nothing, you know. But it isn't just about fighting back in a literal sense. It's about, again, creating the conditions where fascism cannot thrive, and that is in creating communities of care, communities that don't throw people away, communities that you know, have a strong sense of cohesion. And we did that in Berkeley. I mean, we organized like hell, and we got 3,000 people out, you know, when the fascists were supposed to storm our campus, and they never came. And, you know, that gave me life. That really pulled me out of despair.
Yeah.
Was, you know, seeing how after Charlottesville, that the Berkeley community really came together to say no and to stand united. And I knew that was possible. So that's what I did. It was the only thing I knew how to do was to be at the grassroots, to organize communities, to educate people, and to really offer an alternative vision of how this can go. You know, it's like, we could do this the easy way, or we could do it the hard way. Well, it looks like we're doing this the hard way. Well, we can still do it, you know. And it's really that survivor spirit, I think, that has, you know, really informed so much of my decision making in this latter part of my life. Is very interesting. But, you know, I am a product. I exist because my people survived. A lot of us exist because our people survived the most horrific things. And so I'm confident we can survive too. But we have to get together to do it. We have to organize. Because that's what our ancestors did. And and that's what guides me really throughout all of this.
This is listener supported KZFR Community Radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. I'm Corey Hunt on the Peace and Social Justice Show. This is a Sapien session with Mel Figueroa. And as we jump back in the conversation, Figueroa is describing how an understanding of apocalypse actually gives her hope.
Sure. I'm going to start with the thing that scares everybody, actually.
Do it.
That's the word apocalypse.
Mm, interesting.
I know everybody was throwing around that word last year with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are still throwing around that word when it comes to climate. Look at the heat wave right now.
Sure.
Everything seems really apocalyptic, doesn't it?
Yes.
Right? But if you go and you look at the true meaning of the word,
okay,
if you go all the way back to the Greek, apocalypse means a revealing.
Did not know that.
It is the revealing of the true history of the world.
Wow.
And that...
Wow.
That is the one thing. I mean, you know... Yeah, it seems really weird to sort of like go around and I'm like, you know, we're doing Willow, we're doing all of this like beautiful stuff mm-hmm. in the midst of such dark things and mm-hmm. despair. But what really pulled me out of despair was knowing the true history of the world, knowing my history, my ancestors' history, knowing that just three generations ago, my grandfather's generation, we survived a genocide. Mm. If people don't know this, this is 1901 in the Philippines. My dad's island, Samar, is known in U.S. history as the island that burned because... so we fought back against the American occupation. Mm. And in retaliation, General Jacob H. Smith of the U.S. Marines mm-hmm. ordered the total destruction of the island and the killing of every Filipino over the age of 10. Anywhere between 50,000 and 200,000, up to, some estimates say up to 600,000 Filipinos mm-hmm. died in that massacre. And it really was a very... And what's interesting, I'm finding out that even some of the sons of the settlers here in California that carried out the genocide against California Native people... Mm-hmm. Their sons went to the Philippines to carry out a genocide against mm-hmm. my people.
Jeez.
And knowing that was my grandfather was alive during that. Mm-hmm. Understanding that he survived, that my family survived, a lot of people survived. An apocalypse.
Yeah.
A real apocalypse.
Yeah.
A cultural and, you know... And then meeting Allie and meeting, you know, I'd been working also, I went to Standing Rock, I dealt in a superficial way with some, Native activists. But coming back and really understanding that, you know, to learn from the people who survived, to tap into that history. How did people survive? How did... Mm. You know, and of course, you know, Black history and the whole history of enslavement and resistance and resilience and all of the sort of the pieces of culture that come out of that, the pieces that, you know, we and our ancestors held on to. It's useful to think about that Black and brown people have already gone through apocalypse. Right. And so this apocalypse doesn't seem so scary after that.
When you put it that way, yeah. Huh? So when you put it that way, that's an amazing observation, you know? Actually. That is very powerful.
And actually understanding that in our history and in our, you know, in some of our DNA and in some of our cultures lies the seeds for surviving this.
Mm.
We can do it. We are the, you know, we're the global majority. And even people who are not Black and brown can realize that too.
Mm.
Because in the history of resistance, resisting the apocalypse on this continent are also European stories. John Brown,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, when I was going in Northeast Brazil, which is the poorest region in Latin America, you know, there are all of these... resistance communities or descendants of resistance communities mm-hmm. spread all throughout the interior that combine indigenous, African, and European people and pieces of knowledge to survive enslavement and genocide. Those are pieces that we need to pick up again and, you know, take into the light, take mainstream. Those are the things I think that will help us survive. Because when we think about, like, okay, how are we going to survive planetary collapse or fascism or anything like that? You know, we're not going to get it from the ruling class.
No.
The ruling class is literally that because they have denied those parts of us. So all of the things that are hidden, the things with even within our families that are hidden, I've discovered so much more about my family history looking at it from this perspective than I ever would have. I wouldn't have noticed those things otherwise. We have between all of us, between our diverse communities, we have so many tools. We have so many tools that we don't even know we have. And to reveal that history, to learn it, to learn about other people's histories, to pick up those tools and put them together into new mechanisms for understanding and living in this world now, that's the greatest hope I have. You know?
Indeed. This has been so powerful. I actually do not want to cut any of it out. So I will go to three questions and a proverb.
It's not just a question, but an exercise, a mental exercise that I want to challenge people with. Again, this has to do with learning that true history of the world. Because, and I've definitely been learning this since, you know, learned a lot of this from Allie, learned a lot of this place, right? Once you start, I've been starting as a geographer, because that's sort of where my training is in geography. But geography to me is also about like reading landscapes, like being able to look out your window in your car and understand what's actually going on outside. And when you learn history and you learn the true history of the world, landscapes start to look more like a layer, you know, in academic, in highfalutin academic parlance, we call it a palimpsest. Palimpsest is like images that are like layered on top of one another. Mm-hmm. So like you see the elements of like the other layers in
the top layer.
Right. I think they also use that in Photoshop or something like that. But when you start to see, once you start to know the history, and especially after, you know, learning so much from Allie, the history of this land in particular, you know, you don't look out your window and see the same thing that you've seen before. You start to see what lies underneath. Like I said before, you go down the five and you don't see just brown hills anymore. You see colonization, you see ownership, the flattening of the valley, right? You know, that this should be wetlands, this should have water, this, you know, and you start to see a different kind of landscape superimposed on what you actually see.
That's a great point.
And part of And so thinking, I guess it's just a mental exercise. I said, next time y'all take a road trip, next time y'all take, you know, something, learn something about the history of the places you are going. Learn about the original people. Learn about what happened. And you look at those, you know, look at those hills, look at those creeks. You'll never look at them the same way again. And once you don't look at them the same way again, the more that you will yearn to turn that soil back over and return it to the state that it was. And that's what will motivate, you know, that's what motivates me at least.
I'm motivated. I'm ready to get out right now. Jeez, that was dope. That was awesome.
You know? So, yeah. So start seeing your landscapes as palimpsests, I guess. And... all right, I'll leave you with a proverb that my grandmother used to say.
Awesome.
And she used to say it in her very thick Filipino accent. She'd say, "Your foolishness will go home to your body."
It's a little... my God. If you could have told me that 20 years ago, that would be great. Because I'm feeling it.
Oh, yeah. Well, my foolishness has gone home to my body a few times as well. But that's the way that I think about things like karma. I think about things like F around and find out, which is definitely a year for effing around and finding out.
This is the year.
But yeah, just that awareness of you know, your actions are not just going to affect you, but it might affect you down the line. And you can still choose to make a foolish choice. I still do that. I'm like, sure, well, maybe just one time, okay. But
it's a dance.
Yeah. And also, you know, it helps us think of the people who are powerful and doing bad things right now as not all powerful. I know it seems that way sometimes, and I know that, you know, it's hard and it's difficult to see all these bad things happen. But as we've found out in the last city council, it's coming back around. It can come back around to them too. And it's not, you know, of course, it's not a formula. It's not like a, do nothing. You know, it's not an admonition to do nothing. It's go forward and make sure that your actions pay it forward. The more that your actions will pay it forward, because they're not thinking about that. They're thinking about short term. Mm. Their actions going to come back to them, right? Mm. But as long as we make sure our actions pay forward, it will build for the future. Like I said, they cannot win their war. Like, their objective, what? To create a all-white, suburban, like, capitalist society? Like,
it's not a thing.
It was impossible from the get-go.
Yes.
And they've done so much damage to make this fantasy real, but it's something that can never be real. Mm. It can never be real, because it's always going to come back around. Because we are still here, we still survive, you know? And so... yeah, I mean, I guess that's for a long view, and I guess I just gave a couple of things to help people not fall into despair right now, but I guess that's important.
Very, very.
That's really important. A lot of people are looking very bleakly at the world ahead, but if we just keep going, don't give up, and make sure our actions pay it forward so that we're building as we go, I think that helps us be more patient with ourselves, and also that, you know, we have a horizon that is realistic, that we are going forward. Theirs is absolutely not realistic. So.
I thank you so much, Mel, for your time. I don't know who else needed to hear this, but I sure did. This is very, it's been uplifting, because I fall into, right, everything that you're talking to, I fall all the way into that, that despair of just, man, goodness. You know, because I see so many people who could easily get it and choose not to. And that, and then that focus in that area definitely can cause me a bit of probably unnecessary grief, unproductive grief at least. And so the words that you shared here today, I can't explain to you how powerful and helpful and healing they are for me personally, and I imagine for others. So I thank you for that and your time and all of your works.
Thank you. Thank you.
Again, much gratitude to Mel Figueroa, such a powerful spirit and such a compelling journey, and just important, poignant messages. I hope you all were able to absorb something from that as I was. And next up, I had a stop at the local coffee shop and spoke with an exported talent, Natalie Hansen Ross, the former journalist of the Chico ER, sat with me and gave me some of her time speaking to her experiences in the town. And as we sat after the interview, I found out that she actually was homeless at a younger age, and that kind of informs how she became so empathetic and aware of, you know, the homeless issue, and was able to do such a passionate job writing about it. And so, immense gratitude. And we'll start this Sapient session with just that, speaking to her background.
Well, so my background is my mom, it's always been one parent working and one not, which was some privilege earlier in life. My dad was let go from a journalism job. I think I was 7. And then my mom taught elementary school. We lived in Arizona. So pretty, and we were able to get by on, I think it was like $40,000 a year. So back then, before the recession. So we always had a home and we were fine. My mom passed away in 2010. So from then on, my dad struggled to get a job. He held a job here and a job there. But from then on, it was always uncertain of whether we would have a home or... there was a point I've couch surfed, he's couch surfed, my brother's couch surfed. So there, we are stable now and have been for some time, but I guess once you've had that experience, especially while trying to get through high school, that's always going to color how I see things from then on.
I can't believe you almost skipped over that.
That's fine. I'm not used to that. So I went to Chico High. I'm going to go back that far because I always knew I wanted to write. But I have a journalist father, former journalist, and then my mother's an English teacher. And I saw the issues with both. So I had no idea, how am I going to write and make it something I can actually do as an adult? But in high school, for one short period, we had a journalism program and we did broadcasting, and that was some of the best. That stuff kept me in high school. And so when I left, however, I realized I did not like broadcasting as a career. I saw a lot of issues with the industry as a whole. So I started rethinking, what would journalism look like for me? And I just got very, very lucky that Butte College still had a newspaper. I wrote in one semester at San Diego Community College, and then I came back and did the Roadrunner. And so shout out to Tom, who used to be on Chico News and Review. He really showed me what community journalism could look like in Butte County and what that meant to looking at the entire community, not just Chico. And then I went to Chico State, of course, was on the Orion for 3 years, and that really got my feet on the ground, and I realized there was no going back. This is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
You're listening to Natalie Hansen Ross, a local journalistic powerhouse, formerly of the Chico ER. I'm Corey Hunt here on the Peace and Social Justice Show. Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by regional and continuing education at Chico State, offering online graduate test preparation courses for those seeking an advanced degree in a wide range of fields, including law and business. Sign up for a complimentary strategy session to help you prepare to take the GRE, GMAT, or LSAT at rce.csuchico.edu. And by Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves, but drink with others.
As someone who hasn't gone to school for any of this, I kind of wonder if that's even what I am. You know, I'm not really drawn to it or feel any type of way whether I am or not. And so I kind of wanted to question you, as someone who is going through all the hoops and everything and kind of seeing the ins and outs of a lot of different things, what do you think qualifies someone as a journalist?
That's a big question, especially now that we've been talking so much about the move to digital and the loss of print over time. And that's been going on since I was in high school, and even more so now, especially during the pandemic. We've watched so many jobs disappear, and we've questioned what makes someone a reporter. I think even if you are not affiliated with an organization, as so many people move to freelance and they begin to develop what it looks like for them to write on and have specifically their own beat and work for different papers, I think you do need to take into account journalistic integrity as the history of it and what it was designed for. I think we've certainly had a lot of conversations in the past year about what no longer works about the old rules and the old standards newsrooms would try to apply. I think we realize the systemic issues with the industry a little better. I think we're learning, and I think that conversation is wide open right now. I think that reporters should understand the history of why we do things and really pay attention to the standards with an AP style, but also understand how they were created and be willing to question, you know, what voices am I picking? What sources am I spotlighting? It's always important to try to gather as many voices as possible, but also to understand why in the past voices have not been handed the mic, so to speak. Mm. So there's this whole conversation, this is a little off, but there's this whole conversation going on right now of stop saying, I am the voice for the voiceless.
Mm.
Because you are saying these people do not have a voice. They have always had a voice, and that needs to be retired in journalism, and that it points to old industry standards that you believe you, the reporter, are the center of the conversation, and you decide who gets the mic. Luckily, I came of age in school during a period when we begin to say, just hand them the mic, listen to your neighborhood, get on the street, find out what's actually happening. Don't just go to one source, typically the people in power, and call it good. So
you went right to somewhere where I wanted to touch on for sure, because that's something I really respect about your writing, is it has this I'll step it back. Do you believe in, like, objective reporting? Do you think that's a thing?
I think we should strive for it. I was definitely trained you have to follow the standards of objectivity. We talked a lot about utilitarianism as it's applied to journalism, and how the extreme utilitarian journalists would include all information at all points, mm-hmm. throw it out there and say, okay, reader, you make the decision. Mm-hmm. However, as we know, that is simply not possible of every human. So we need to consider just how much information we can fit into a story in a very brief period of time, very brief period of the reader paying attention to you. So you have to be concise, and you have to be very certain of what is fact. And so living in a post-truth condition as we are now, that is, I think that's why it's very difficult for me to be sure anyone can be objective.
Sure.
Because we all have our backgrounds, we all have our unique perspectives. And as we talked about for the past several years, we should have been talking about it longer, but especially now it's a normal conversation of how much race and class play a part in what you will be talking about and who you'll be talking to. So I would say I think we should strive for it. I don't know at this point how successful we are being at it, and I think most newsrooms feel that way.
Brings me to my next point that I was jumping the gun on is, yeah, I think you're doing, from my personal perception, you know, or perspective, a wonderful job of creating this, you know, balanced conversation, which I personally struggle with, you know, is I lean more, and I'm honest about, I'm not objective. I try to create an objective for the major conversation that's already dominated by a certain voice. And so I try to, as you say, not be the voice of this voiceless, quote unquote, but give a voice and give a space to the marginalized that don't normally have that space. But in your reporting, I really respect how you give a voice to a lot of different, to be able to give you an informed opinion. I really feel informed about the things that you write about. And I guess that's just me long-windedly thanking you again. But my next question would be, what is your goal? You know, what is your goal with your writing or with your journalism?
I think I've been able to take time to be sure that I want to be in community journalism and really study, especially in communities that are quickly becoming news deserts or are in danger of becoming news deserts. So not having access to information that is up to date and accurate is a real danger, I think, especially for, we're talking about rural, underserved communities, typically much higher poverty rates. And I think especially in areas where disaster strikes or is very likely to strike, considering the effects of climate change we're seeing all over the country right now, I think that's where I really want to hopefully end up, because I think it has a, I think journalism has a public good, but I think particularly when you know that sometimes you're the only one people can hear when the fire is coming, literally coming, and they turn to you because that's where the information is coming from. In the sea of misinformation, I think we've missed out on that. And I think people, that's why people need to have the trust in local news. But that means that even when there's not a disaster, that's when you really have to be diligent and do the work, show that you're listening to everybody in the community.
And you're listening to Natalie Hanson Ross, formerly of the Chico ER, here on KZFR 90.1. If you're enjoying this program, you can head over to KZFR.org and tip the show.
What kind of drove you to Chico?
Well, that's easy. I live here, but I live here. I started here in high school.
Okay. Yeah.
But
yeah.
So I happened to get on the ground in college, and then I got the rare opportunity to work for the local paper while I was in college. So, it was also extremely important to me to write here, because as I was really studying journalism here, I really began to get a sense of how richly layered this community is. There's been a lot that's changed, particularly in the last maybe 25 years, especially during the recession. And I think there's so much to write about here. I never, ever didn't have a story idea. I usually had like way too many and I would try to remember them all the time. And so that's really, really exciting. I think that's the best a journalist can hope for, is you are in a community where so much is going on, but you also feel you can really have a sense of your own ability to talk to people. I think that that gets lost sometimes when you go to places where one news source dominates. As you know, news is mostly owned by hedge funds right now, and there's no getting around that. There are some nonprofit news organizations. There is quite a bit of discussion of how journalism can be alternatively sourced or alternatively funded. And I think that Chico has its own fair share of those as well. There's still that need for journalism when you look at how much it could turn into a news desert, how much misinformation spreads, especially with Facebook, especially with how social media becomes some people's only window into what's going on.
Speaking of the Facebooks, do you read the comments?
Yes.
And does that affect, you know, how your approach? I mean, obviously at some level, but is it like a cognitive thing where you like go out and try to appease the community in that way? Or is it just more of a just radar entertainment type thing?
I think it's important to know what is happening in the community in that sense. I think there's a point where you need to stop. And I definitely reached a point where I realized I needed to stop reading them. And it didn't affect my reporting really. But I worked very hard to make sure of that. But it did affect how I was thinking of the community to a point where I knew it was not healthy. There are more conversations around journalism and mental illness, which I'm very thankful for. But especially after the series of fires we've had and then the series of political incidents we've had where trauma of the entire community has to be considered. So I had to start thinking about how much of this is necessary for me to know to be able to go out and talk to people and understand the story. There's a point where you should not be reading it. It's not necessary. You can do your job without knowing what people are saying in these corners.
Well put. It sounds like a difficult dance to do. And that brings me to another inquiry is, you know, what would you say maybe might have been your most difficult lesson through this journey so far? Or is that something in the front of your mind at this point? You're just winging it and going with the flow.
Yes and no. It's both. The most difficult thing has been knowing how to navigate a period where it feels like sometimes there's no true truth for many people. And that is an extremely frightening thing, I think, for most people, not just journalists, but everybody, to recognize. There's a sense that there is no true way to know when you're getting good information. And I think part of that, personally, I believe some of that is that people don't really have media literacy skills, and it's very difficult to vet sources and look through websites and know what you're looking at is false. So that's really scary. I think the most frightening thing about the last year was the way conspiracy theories permeated everything, knowing how to sort through it and knowing to trust my ability to get through it and find to just report the facts.
We appreciate you doing that work, and I appreciate you giving me this time here today. So many questions. I just want to give you an opportunity to speak to that. Yeah, the importance of a trustworthy free press.
I think you need to start with understanding your community, and that requires a lot of time and work. I think a lot more than people realize. I think that there's a lot of work to be done within the industry to understand why we've been doing things the way we've been doing them for so long, and to know when it's working and when it's hurting our ability to report the truth. And that applies to accountability, that applies to questioning authority, which I personally believe that journalism was designed to do in the first place. And since then, things have changed for multiple reasons, in part because of funding sources. I think that when you go back to basics and people see that you are willing to talk to everyone on all sides of the track, so to speak, and do the work to actually create relationships, that's what we need to go back to. And that is a lot of work. Journalists are overworked. There's too few of us. We're not paid enough. We just aren't. A lot of us are probably struggling to eat as well. But we still have to at least try to get out there and create relationships so that I really think your ability to tell in-depth stories is hurt if you can't do that or won't do that and be willing to take the flack for it.
Yeah, I am still getting that personally, but I hear you. I agree, too. I totally agree. I think that is... It's the hardest, or the most necessary stuff is usually the hardest. That's why it's not getting done often. And to that point of you all not getting paid enough, that seems by design as well, to keep, you know, our best and brightest, you know, from wanting to get involved. And so I thank you for jumping over that hurdle. Do you have any highlights of your experience as a journalist in Chico?
I mean, it would have to be writing about issues of poverty and really the effects of climate change, which the campfire and the effects of ongoing financial stress on this community, I think were really highlights. Even though those were the most controversial, I think, and talking about our unsheltered humans and why they become unsheltered, I think that is something that we are all confronting everywhere right now. But I think because of that, I really had to learn very quickly, and I really had to take a lot of care in that. But I think those are that's the necessary work. And how do I put this? That is what forces you to confront who's controlling the information. And when you recognize you are one of those people, it can really change your own perspective and why you're even in it. And I think that's why some people have left in the past year. And in the past year, I've seen a lot of people leave and reconsider being in the industry. And I completely understand it. I did write about that we had a year-end issue, and we were all invited to write our perspective on reporting during COVID. And I focus more on why many people are leaving, but why it's still necessary. And I can understand why many people have many obstacles for not being in journalism anymore. And I'm currently in it because I still think you can do something with it, and it still has value. It's just, I think you have to have your eyes wide open. But it's still been a highlight, recognizing that through writing about these issues in our own community.
You know, I could sit here all day, but I thank you for your time, and I don't want to take it all. This being Sapient Sessions, I usually close out each segment by asking my guests, or giving them an opportunity to ask listeners, three questions they think would be beneficial, and giving them a favorite quote.
What makes you get up every day to do the heart work within yourself? What makes you question what you want versus what the world is telling you you need?
Could you mind elaborating on that one a little bit?
I was thinking about the pressure to have a job and have a career and the pressure to make money, which in this profession you're always wrestling with.
Sure.
What about your current situation is not sustainable, and what are you going to do about it? Printing what someone else does not want printed. Everything else is public relations. But I need to figure out who said that, because if that's going to be a problem. Okay, well, they think it's George Orwell, but I don't think it is. Yeah. You can say it's attributed to George Orwell, but it's now coming out that they don't think he said it. Now they're saying it's the former publisher of the Washington Post, Katharine Graham, used to say it. Okay, well, you can do the investigative work. Oh, look, Lord Northcliffe. News is what somebody somewhere wants to suppress. All the rest is advertising. Okay, so that was said. He's a British newspaper owner in the 19th. That's what my journalism professor said, that it actually goes way back. So you can say Lord Northcliffe, often attributed to George Orwell, which is not true, to be accurate.
What a perfect ending to such a wonderful Sapient session. Such a bright, powerful spirit. Natalie Hansen Ross, thank you again for your time, and I hope you all gained some sapience from that session. One more session coming up with the 24-year-old organizer and activist, sociology student from Chico State, Abraham Infante. But first...
Hey there, it's Megan. Here's a way to simplify your life. That vehicle you don't use anymore, working or not, it can benefit KZFR. Think about it, then donate it. You can call our vehicle donation support team, available 7 days a week, at 888-593-7288. That's 888-593-7288.
Abraham, I thank you for your time. I became aware of you through some organizing you were doing around the Palestinian or the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And I appreciate you doing that. I actually got out to one of your protests that you guys were having a few weeks back and was able to speak to someone, and they were able to give listeners some valuable information, and I wanted to kind of circle back as I hear the decibel kind of lowering around the awareness of what's going on around there. Kind of wanted to flame that understanding and inspiration to kind of stay involved and do what we can and at least just be aware.
Yes.
And so I thank you for your time, and I wanted to ask you, how did you become aware of the occupation?
It was probably 2018 or early 2019. I took a U.S. government class at Butte College.
Okay.
And one of the professors offered an extra credit option, and it was to watch The Occupation of the American Mind. And I watched it, I did the extra credit, and that's essentially how I became aware. And since then, I've been trying to learn more about the issue as well as bringing awareness to the issue. I just saw a lot of similarities that are happening in Palestine that happened here and are still happening here in the United States.
Mm.
So that's how I found out about the issue. It's actually very recent if you think about it.
Definitely, yeah. I think that's an important factor of it as well, because it's often framed as a religious struggle when in reality it's a colonial struggle.
Yes.
From my perspective. And I think that's important to name. I thank you for naming that. And what do you think is some of the more important things about that struggle that American citizens should know?
Great question. Like I said, there was just a lot of similarities. Actually, ever since the two protest rallies that I organized here in Chico, and, you know, since a lot of stuff started to happen again in Palestine, I started to look at this country a lot differently in terms of, like, not seeing it as a country, seeing it more as a settler colony. So I think it's important for Americans to recognize those similarities. What happened 200 years ago and it continues to happen here is what's happening in Palestine right now. So I think that we should stop. I mean, I guess the most important thing I want people to get out of it as Americans is that we are funding the genocide that's going on over there. So regardless of what the politics are, regardless of where you stand on those politics, I just think it's important to know that we are actively funding that genocide, and we can't call ourselves, you know, innocent or wash our hands clean when we're perpetuating that violence.
Great point. Yeah, tax dollars and a lack of awareness of what's happening with those is a crucial component of American privilege. This has been going on for quite some time, our whole lives, even though, you know, it's not, there's people, my father was born in 1940, and so he was born before there was even a such thing as Israel. And so, you know, I always want to keep that in context when I say, you know, it's been going on for a while. But so I say that to say, what inspired your most recent organizing events as far as the protests that you did downtown?
I'm from Salinas, California, which is by Monterey Bay.
Yeah.
So I moved up here for college, and I've been here for about 4 years now, and I've met Palestinians. I have friends who are Palestinians. So I think that's part of what fueled it hugely, because I see how much it hurts and devastates them, and I just can't stand by. And again, it's like the least I could do was just make up something, right? Whether it's a protest, a rally. I know it's Chico. You might think like, oh, it's a small town. Who cares? But I think it's just really important. So I think it was my friends who fueled that, and also just really like doing my part, because I'm not gonna like sit back and just not do anything. Like, there's an actual genocide going on. People are getting killed, their homes are being destroyed, and yeah, I couldn't just stand by. So I think that's part of a huge part was my friends and that, and then just learning about what it is. I think just decency, I guess.
So two things you were saying there is you were hanging out, and for lack of a better term, you were spending time with Palestinians. And so I think that's something that's really important across all boards of oppressional struggle, is just getting out there and getting to know people from different backgrounds. And I think that's the best thing we can do, because we can go on YouTube and learn things and we can read this and read that, but there's nothing like that direct contact with people. And so I think that's a great point. And then your friends encouraging you, I think that's another great point of to remember that we have that power to do what you did and get off our behinds and not wait for the next person to do something, but just do whatever we can. You know, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to do something right. Type energy, you know. I think that's a great thing. And then friends encouraging our friends to do the same, you know, because so often, which I'm not against, but so often we critique our friends in efforts to better them. And I think it's important to remember to encourage each other, you know, of what we can do. You know, it's important to help us stay accountable to ourselves and each other, but it's also important to keep us lifted and lit up with light, so we can shine that light for each other. So I thank you for naming those two things as well.
Of course.
Let's see. And so on that same note, other than friends, in this post-Trump era, information has been such a tricky thing to get a hold of in a trustworthy manner.
Right.
So what are you doing necessarily to stay up to date with the conflict and things like that? Do you have any certain resources that help, that you trust?
Yes, I do have a couple of resources. They mostly come from the Palestinian friends I follow on social media.
Uh-huh.
I usually take their guidance in terms of like the information that's being spread out.
Very important.
I think it's really what's helping Palestine. Social media has been helping Palestine in terms of like you said, this has been going on way before we were born, and the only difference now is that they can actually record and upload their stuff online and not rely on mainstream or big news outlets to provide them with that information.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we live in an age where like two things, in my opinion, are really important, which is critical thinking and groupthink. Like, watching out for those two things are important for me. You know, obviously, like, doing your due diligence and everything you read. You can even get into conspiracy theories, but as long as you're doing your due diligence right and you know how to critically think about those, about what you're searching, is important, is key. And then watching out for groupthink, because that's huge nowadays, and it's very... it can be very dangerous. I think people underestimate groupthink.
You're listening to Abraham, the organizer who put together the Palestinian awareness protests last month in downtown Chico. And this is KZFR 90.1, the Peace and Social Justice Show. And Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by CNA Cleaning, serving Chico, Paradise, Durham, and Orville since 1989. Bonded and insured, CNA Cleaning offers regular and one-time residential and commercial cleaning services using environmentally friendly cleaning products. CNA Cleaning also offers ultrasonic blind cleaning. For more information or for employment opportunities, call CNA Cleaning at 514-7738. And by Chico Community Acupuncture, offering accessible and effective health care through acupuncture. Chico Community Acupuncture offers a sliding scale and provides relief from aches and pains, stress reduction, and helps promote general wellness at 1815 Mangrove Avenue. Appointments and information at ChicoCommunityAcupuncture.com, on Facebook, and at 345-5300. Si hablo español.
And so, you know, the protests were a few weeks ago, and, you know, protests only do so much. I'm all for protests, but that's just the awareness, and that's a jump off. Too often that ends up being the end all be all. People come out to the protests, take their little selfies, and they've saved the world in their mind, you know. And so I wanted to give you an opportunity to speak to what you think should be next.
Yes, so I am planning to do another rally protest next month, July.
Okay.
You know, it's interesting because the first one I organized, it was actually a pretty nice turnout. I was actually surprised at the amount of people that showed up to that. But then the next weekend, we did it again, and obviously it was a much smaller turnout.
Sure.
So that's expected. I mean, all I ask of people is really to just show up, you know? It's the least that they could do. Come
the
on.
Least.
The very least that they could do. So one of the beautiful things about Chico, which is, like, very rare to say, but I like the community in this town. And obviously it can go on, like, either side of the political spectrum. However, community really does show up. All I really did was, like, I posted on social media, like, hey, I'm planning on organizing a rally around Palestine, and then people reached out, and I thought that was beautiful. I really appreciated that. And it was a sweet little reminder. Angela Davis came to Chico State.
Yes.
And one of the things that she said was, you know, community shows up, like, don't be afraid that you're going to be alone. You know, you make your stance, you put yourself out there, and people are going to gravitate towards you.
That's important, yes.
Yes, and I took that, and it was right after Angela Davis that I actually
That's
felt
awesome.
A little bit
That's
more inspired
awesome.
To do it. Yeah.
That's very awesome. Speaking of Angela Davis, I was recently reading her book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, and that is directly tied to this as far as what she was doing largely there is tying together American struggles with the Palestinian struggle. She's talking about Ferguson directly, mostly. I think she wrote it around that time of Mike Brown being killed by police. And it's just very powerful. So I think that's a very important thing as well, is get your read on, you know, don't just read the Facebooks. But, you know, there's so many scholars doing so much awesome work. That's what I was realizing, too, the other day. You know, as I've been doing this work, I'm 40 now. And about 10, 15 years ago, I kind of snapped out of the American conditioning, or began to anyways. Okay. And so I've been doing this work. And over the years, you've just seen the evolution of consolidated information. And I think that's such a beautiful thing that it's a privilege to be alive to here and now, to where now you could just go on one of these platforms and watch, like, All the Brutes, or Exterminate All the Brutes, and things like that. Yes. And it's just so much information that took, you know, 10 years ago, it would have took you 10 years to gather something that you could just sit down now for 5 hours. And so there's really no excuse. And so it's like you were saying, just show up and just care, you know. And so, and I thank you for showing up. Here on this segment, before I move on, I just want to give you some space and an opportunity to speak to anything that you think needs to be mentioned that maybe we didn't touch on just yet.
I mean, you touched on it briefly, and I think that's something I should have touched on before, which
Please.
Is in terms of American citizens trying to understand what's going on in Palestine. I think one important part is the state-sanctioned violence.
Yes.
Which is the police violence that goes on in the United States, the same thing that's going on with the IDF in Palestine.
Yes.
So, yes, I think if Americans really want to understand police brutality and police violence, Palestine is a really good point to try to.
Exactly. Vice versa. Yeah. If you want to understand what's happening in Palestine, understand what's happening with, you know, the BLM push for, you know, ending qualified immunity and just addressing state sanctioned violence, like you mentioned, you know, it's something that it can, as a black man in America, it can be frustrating and exhausting to deal with, because it's something that we, you know, as I'm driving here or anywhere, I see a police officer, it's a professor, Dr. Johnson was just naming this on Facebook, speaking to how we practice, you know. I can't speak for other marginalized groups, but I know as black folks, when we see the police, in our head, it's an instinct to just practice what you gonna say, what you gonna do, how you gonna avoid getting killed in this instant, you know what I mean, for a lot of us anyways. And I think that's just something that makes it difficult to communicate with people who don't experience that, because then when they have their defensive denial deflection type reaction, and you're already in this lifetime of trauma, you know, that you're being vulnerable from, yeah. It can be difficult to avoid the fight or flight reaction of I'm scared for my life, what do you mean, you know what, yeah. I mean, type frustration reaction. I kind of lost my point there, but I just think it's important for people to understand that there is things that some people are going through that you may not understand, but it's just important to give them space and just listen. Like you were saying, how your Palestinian friends have been a main educator for you. I think that should be most people's main educator, not one person, you know, because often I see.
I'm rambling.
Fine, no worries. I appreciate a good ramble. Go ahead.
Often I see folks that are just privileged seek out someone saying what they want to hear. You know, like a Candace Owens, for example, or something like that. When there's this plethora of scholars and Ibram Kendis and, you know, Angela Davises, all these people with actual accolades to that region of knowledge, but they look over all of that and then they're like, see, this woman is a patriot because right. She's saying what I believe. And I'm not sure what my point was there, but I definitely wanted to just name that.
Yeah. No worries.
I haven't had breakfast. All right, we're moving along though. And so, yeah, I thank you so much for your time, Aaron, and I appreciate you just taking that step. I wanted to give people an opportunity to hear you anyway, mm-hmm. and just hear that they are the change that they're waiting to see. Yes. You know what I mean? We need so many more people to just take that slight initiative that you took and with many hands makes light work.
Yes.
And so I again want to thank you for taking that initiative and encourage others to appreciate do the same.
And also keep an eye out this month for another Palestinian awareness protest downtown. And before we got out of there, I asked them about three questions and a proverb, and here it was.
I like that. That's good. That makes me think. So three questions and a quote. Okay. My first question is, what aspects of American identity do you feel heavily indoctrinated to? Mm. And if you could get rid of anything Americana, what would it be? And lastly, I'd like people to think about the binary paradigms we live within.
Mm.
And that obviously includes gender, even our political spectrum.
Sure.
And how can we move forward towards a more inclusive space?
Yes.
And my quote is by Alice Walker. Activism is my rent for living on this planet.
Beautiful. Amazing. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Corey.
And that concludes that Sapien session and this episode of the Peace and Social Justice Show. What a gift it has been sitting with so many different people and from so many diverse backgrounds and they all just have so much amazing gems to share. It's in something unexpected every time I sit down with these folks and just listen. And so that just is another testament to the power of listening. And sharing as well, sharing what you have, you know, getting up and, you know, community will show up as Abraham was alluding to Angela Davis, quote. So you have to show up in order for you to receive your blessings, you know. And so I'm grateful for you all showing up here on KZFR 90.1, checking out this episode of the Peace and Social Justice Show. And as always, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. I'm Hemp C. Corey Hunt, Soapbox, signing out. Stay tuned for Playing Dead.
Okay, that was an incredible Sapience session of the Peace and Justice Program. And it will be archived immediately and be available for you if you miss part of it or all of it. I wanted to just announce something. This is per This is from Butte County Shelter for All, per Julie and Lisa Currier, who attended today's hearing in Sacramento. The temporary restraining order in the case against Chico has been extended. It seems the judge is not happy with the city's death camp proposal. There's apparently going to be more mediation between the defendants and plaintiffs, and the judge will issue a ruling next week. From Julie, Lisa Currier says, "What happened in court today? The TRO was extended. They did not like the idea of the situation at the airport. There's going to be mediation between Judge England and the city and the plaintiffs and the defendants. Then our judge will make a ruling. It's going to put a preliminary decision for next week, so we should know more by next Wednesday or Thursday, hopefully to see what he's saying." So he is a very articulate judge. Our side did beautifully. I'm really proud of them. The city, I have no words. And that was from Lisa Currier. Stay tuned for Playing Dead. I'm going to give you some Richie Haven for a transition, and stay cool and have some peace, please. Happy 4th of July as you celebrate it.
Clap your hands.